Welcome everyone to Talking Shop Down Under. This is your host Richard Banks, and welcome to yet another fun-filled, crazy episode of mayhem and otherwise-ness. So for this particular episode of mayhem-filled joy and frivolity, I have with me Mr. OJ Reeves, otherwise known as the Colonial.
The Colonial.
I have no idea why, by the way.
Would you like to know why?
I would love to know why.
I spent around a year working as a contractor in London over in the UK, and
okay.
I was one of a couple of Aussies on a team of maybe about 8 or 9 contractors, and being a rather opinionated and noisy person, I tended to have a lot to say, and people refer to me as the bloody Colonial. So I kind of liked it. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to use that as an online tag, and it's stuck with me ever since.
Better than being the convict.
Yes, that's what I thought. That's exactly what I thought.
So, OJ, would you, and now is OJ short for anything, by the way, or did your parents just get bored and say, no, we can't think of names, let's just, you know, two character.
My real name is Oliver, and my middle name is John. Oh. And my dad started calling me OJ when I was a very small little boy, and I much prefer the sound of it. It's way more casual than Oliver. So if you refer to me as Oliver, I think I'm being told off.
All right, but this is the point when in the podcast where I have to go and inject some soundtrack, right?
That's right.
Because you've never had those jokes before.
No, not at all. And that's part of the reason why I tend to prefer OJ as well.
all right, I'll resist the urge.
Thank you.
Maybe.
That would be good. What'll he do when he's turned black and blue? He will curse the
day. Somebody named him Oliver. All right, so OJ, for the crowd, the listening throng, and hello, listening throng, by the way, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm a generic sort of polyglot geek living in Brisbane, and for the last 12 or 13 years, I've been predominantly doing Microsoft development. Using C++ and moving into the sort of .NET stack, and not really focusing on anything in particular. I'd say the last sort of few years has been predominantly web apps, using MVC and web forms, and been doing some WPF related stuff as well. But these days I'm lucky to have a mixture of .NET and functional programming work using Erlang.
Using what?
Erlang.
The language of Ur?
It was written by or created by Ericsson in the early 80s to solve a specific problem. And it just so happens that it has quite a few properties that work really well in the web world as well. And it seems to be getting a real following and a resurgence as a result of these properties. And it's a really, really interesting language and exciting language to work with.
All right, so give us we had an episode with Tan a few back now.
I remember that one.
But for those who missed that episode, and for those like me who have short-term memory loss, do you want to just give us a bit of a run-through of some of the features of Erlang that are, I suppose, out of the normal for what we would see from a .NET world, even with some of the functional aspects we've got?
Well, the first and most obvious one to me is the built-in fault tolerance attributes. It was designed in the days where there wasn't really that much tech or language, that many languages around that were able to maintain a sufficient level of uptime to drive telecommunications. Mm-hmm. And so Ericsson created Erlang to be this fault tolerant system that would maximize their uptime. And that's obviously still in the language today. And the way that you write code in Erlang, following the sort of generic Erlang principles, you end up building systems that tend to just keep running. And on top of that, one of the things you need to be able to do to have a fault tolerant system and one that has a great deal of uptime is to be able to update it without bringing down the software. And so as a .NET guy, I'm well and truly sick of restarting services and stopping IIS and uploading code and starting IIS again. In the Erlang world, I just don't have to do that at all.
So that means Erlang's interpreted language?
It runs on a VM. It's compiled.
Yeah.
It runs on ERTS or, ERTS. I can never remember what it stands for.
Erlang Runtime System or something.
It's something like that. And so you compile your Erl files into Beam files. And again, I'm not quite sure what Beam stands for. It's something like someone's name, Erlang Abstract Machine. And I'm not even going to try and attempt to say that person's name because for fear of offending them. So, yeah, so it is.
By the way, I like the assumption that they're listening.
They may well be. But, yeah, it is bytecode and it does run on a VM.
Okay, so how does the restart work then? So normally, or not the restart, the changing of things on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
How does that actually work? I don't quite get it. So an ERL file is a class, as we would normally think of it, or akin to?
Not really. It's more of a module. I mean, given that Erlang was born out of Prolog, the original implementation of Erlang was actually written in Prolog. So there's a lot of the syntax still sort of has Prolog-like qualities. So you don't really have the idea of classes. You have modules, just groupings of functions that have sort of similar context. So you don't really have classes, you just have modules. These modules are what you can hot code load. And depending on the structure of your application, hot code loading can be as simple as recompiling your Erl file and dropping the resulting beam in the runtime folder. And calling out load this particular module function inside the Erlang node itself. And what happens there is Erlang will maintain two different versions of the module. So let's say you were running an application like you were streaming MP3s,
yeah.
And there was a bug in your software, and you fixed it, and you uploaded this new beam to your VM. Behind the scenes, all of the existing connections to your service are still running with the old version. So nobody's affected. But anyone who connects to your service after you've deployed this new version, they will get the new version. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So
there's actually two versions of the code running at once.
Or three or four potentially.
Well, that's
depending
that's
on how fast you update things.
If you upload a third version, then the first version will drop off. So usually,
okay, so there's only ever one in a shadow or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. And when it comes to upgrading full applications, you have this infrastructure called OTP, which stands for the Open Telecom Platform. And there's a bunch of funky code in that, which allows you to probably more properly manage hot code loads across sort of larger infrastructure. So the example I gave is a fairly base example. And for really simple modules and really simple systems, you can get away with doing that. But for more complicated systems, you need to sort of follow the upgrade practices that are sort of documented alongside OTP.
Just to clarify a few things, if I've got module A depending on or using functionality from module B.
Yes.
And we then supply a new module B and update it, and a module A is doing some processing in a loop. It makes a call to the original module B, calls a function, gets a result back, goes through its loop, comes back around again, makes the next call. But during that time, we've done the update.
Yes.
It's going to be going to the new version.
Correct.
On the fly. So this implies then that the language has got to be very functional in nature, because otherwise we're going to have side effects making a mess of things, right?
Absolutely. It's not purely functional and it's not lazy. It's actually a strict language and you can have side effects in your functions. I think the reason why you can get away with it so easy, or part of the reason you can get away with it, is because Erlang sort of this loose declarative language, and the dependencies you have between the modules are not enforced at compile time, which kind of sounds scary to a lot of people who are...
I've gone through that in my head. Say that again. So this is effectively semi-dynamic.
I can see what you're trying to say, and yes. So you compile a module, and that module may reference other modules, but at compile time, it will not enforce that that module exists and can be called. And as someone who has a big background in statically typed languages which enforce this stuff up front during the compilation phase, it was a little surprising to me as well. But it's incredibly flexible. the first thing that comes to mind is, okay, so what happens if the module doesn't exist or the
effectively, it's just it's late binding, right? So it's not dynamic, it's just late binding.
Correct.
Okay, so it's Visual Basic.
I was waiting for that.
It had to be done.
Thankfully, no, it's nothing like Visual Basic.
All right, and for everyone playing the drinking game, that's time to drink.
That's right, down those shots. It does kind of sound a little bit scary, but bear in mind that the philosophy behind writing Erlang applications that are designed to be fault tolerant is you let things crash.
Yeah, no, well, it's not really a problem because if you, well, I suppose, is it a problem? If I change module B, am I allowed to change the call signature?
Yes, you are.
So that would mean module A is making a call to B, which has, say, four parameters in it. And I go, oh, four parameters, are you crazy? That's way too many or not enough. Let's make it 12. Mm-hmm. And I add 12 more parameters, which are all, you know, some of them have to be populated for whatever reason.
Yep.
Module A is going to call through to B. And then because it's going to just do that rebinding or late binding type approach again, it's going to say, well, hang on, you're missing 8 parameters. What the hell's wrong with you, module A? And throw an exception.
It'll crash. Yeah. The process will crash.
There's not an exception that gets thrown on the call. The actual process crashes?
The process crashes. That's right. And when I say process, in the world of Erlang, a process does not mean the same thing as it would in, say, the world of C#.
Oh, so it's not an exe or anything like that.
Correct. So your Erlang node still runs. But behind the scenes, because of the design philosophy behind Erlang, you tend to have lots and lots of processes running at the same time, and they all need to communicate through messages.
So a process being a thread, effectively?
It's much more lightweight than a thread. It's closer to a green thread or a fiber, but I'm certainly no authority on exactly how it's implemented, so that's partly speculation on my behalf. But they're very, very cheap to spin up. And in an Erlang node, you can have, you know, umpteen thousands of these things running side by side without a problem, even on commodity hardware.
Now, just coming back again a little bit, you've mentioned an Erlang node a few times.
I have, yes.
And the node is different to an instance of the runtime?
Well, a node is an instance of the runtime, that's
okay.
Right. Yep.
Okay. So, if I've got a multi-core machine, I could run two nodes?
You can run multiple nodes regardless of the number of cores you have.
Ah, okay.
Just like you could run multiple instances of the same application from .NET, yep, even if you only had single core. So you would still have the
swapping.
Yeah, exactly. But obviously, you would be better if you did have multiple cores. But so Erlang is one of the few languages that, you know, when you write decent Erlang code in, you do get near linear scaling as you get more cores in your machine, because it's this inherently concurrent language. You know, if you need some work done, you spawn up a process and you let that process do the work alongside the current process, and you sort of share your results and you communicate via message passing, just like what we do in the real world.
Now, message passing, there's a number of different definitions of a message, right? So in .NET world, there's, you know, we're not talking about the message bus kind of thing where we actually package up some XML and drop it into a message queue that then gets picked up somewhere else.
Yeah, no, it's not
like that. It's more akin to raising events or making method calls?
I would say it's more akin to having a mailbox alongside a given process. And when you send a message, you're just dropping some information in that mailbox, and then it's the responsibility of the receiving process to reference that mailbox using syntactic sugar. So there's a keyword called receive. And in Erlang, when you call receive, what you're doing is you're saying, I want to examine messages that are coming into my mailbox, essentially. And then you can specify a timeout to say, if I don't receive a message within this time frame, then I'll just carry on doing something else. And so that's how messages are passed around. So you have this, it's a little bit of a quirky syntax, but you have a process identifier and a message, and you send the message to the process identifier using bang or exclamation mark. And that
bang
delivers.
Yeah, you're
bang.
American.
Bang, bang. I got that from university, actually. And so that message then appears in the mailbox of that process, and the process then needs to pick that message up and deal with it. And that's basically how it works. It's very simple.
Okay, so that now a message is not, if I've got one process sending a message to another and I want to get a result back.
Yes.
That implies an asynchronous approach, obviously.
Correct. Yes.
The way is it effectively, if you want that to happen, you send a message into process B, it does something and it sends a message back to process A to be picked up, or is it an inbuilt return this to the sender?
The first thing you said is exactly right. So if I was sending a message to you and I wanted a response, the message I would send to you would contain the stuff I want you to do and my identifier, so you knew where to return the message to. You would go and do your processing, and then you would send a message back to me via that identifier that I sent you, and I would have the responsibility then of picking that up from my mailbox.
Right. Gotcha. So it's all point-to-point communication as well? Is
yes.
Is there a broadcast concept? Like everyone who's listening or everyone, I don't know, these eight processes that are all doing exactly the same thing, I want to tear them down, so I'm going to send them a stop message.
Right. Okay. So I'm gonna answer your question in two different ways. The first part where you said, is there a broadcast
mechanism? I thought you were going to do one in English and one in Klingon, but okay.
No. So when it comes to broadcasting, I don't think that there's an inherent capability built into the language that allows you to just broadcast a message to a bunch of processes. You would have to manually say, send the message to that process, then send the message to that process, then send the message to that process. I don't think there's a broadcast mechanism. But the second part of the statement you made, where it was, I want to bring down a bunch of processes. Now that's a different scenario in Erlang. Now, if we quickly go back to the idea of fault tolerance, in Erlang, you have this idea of a supervisor hierarchy. So you have processes that are dedicated purely to making sure that other processes either stay alive or when they die, they get respawned. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this supervisor that says there are a bunch of processes here doing work, and I'm going to sit here and under a bunch of configuration, depending on whether you want them to, like if one process dies, do you want to just spawn up one process to replace it? If it dies, do you want to kill off all the processes that are underneath the supervisor and respawn all of them? There's different ways that you can set this stuff up. But to answer your question, as far as how you would bring down a bunch of processes are concerned, the short answer is you would put them under the supervisor and you would terminate the supervisor.
Right. Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yep. All right. So then the whole message passing thing then leads to another question. So if we're talking scale out, for instance, obviously we want to get outside the box we're on, you know, live outside the box we live in.
Yep.
Do I have to do anything different to do cluster-based communication, if conceptually? You know, I've got all these different slave machines out there doing the same thing, but I want to send to XYZ somewhere else on a different machine.
Sure. Well, one of the beauties of the language is that taking a program from essentially single-threading or single process and making it multi-process is extremely simple in Erlang compared to many other languages. And you do it in a substantially smaller chunk of code. And there's almost no difference between a parallel or concurrent application on a single node and a parallel or concurrent application distributed across multiple nodes. Whether that node is on the same machine, on a different machine across the network, you're kind of almost ignorant of that. So there's very slight changes to some things that you do. And you have to reference other nodes to pass messages, but inherently the process is exactly the same. You can monitor processes from a supervisor on one node that are running on another node and fire them up on another node. You can pass code around. You can do all kinds of crazy things across nodes. And the code that you use to do that is exactly the same as it would be on a single node, maybe with one extra parameter for a given function call. And that's it. It's really that simple.
And then your only real speed issue there is just latency between the two machines.
Yeah, and the message that you're sending and how chatty your communication would be. But you get that with absolutely
any time you go across the wire, that's an issue.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly right.
So putting it into a more concrete example, let's say I'm doing video processing and I want to take some video and turn it to black and white.
Mm-hmm.
You know, get all funky and arty and put sepia tones in and whatever else. So what I would do from a design point of view is I'd have something, an initial Erlang process that looks at the file and then chunks it.
Sure, yep.
Sends a message to X number of processes on Y number of boxes.
Mm-hmm.
That says you are processing this little chunk, and I would send that chunk as a message, or if I said to go load this little bit of file,
mm-hmm.
and then drop the... Okay, so probably the question I'm asking is, if I send them to, you know, load this file from this pointer to this length,
mm-hmm.
Would I get contention on the file? Or is it, you know, is there a size of the message that I'm going to be limited to? So if I went through that chunking process and just basically mm-hmm. sent a binary chunk with my message and said process
mm-hmm.
this,
mm-hmm.
would that work?
It would work, yeah. I mean, you're always going to end up...
That was a roundabout way of asking the question, but got there eventually.
I know what you mean. So if we had a, you know, 10 gigabyte video that you wanted to apply these filters to,
yeah.
and you wanted to distribute that load across a bunch of Erlang nodes, then that's a perfect use case of where Erlang would really help you, because doing that kind of work is what this thing is very capable of doing. And doing in a pretty small amount of code. And this kind of stuff does happen all the time. I think your design is completely up to you, whether or not you want each individual process to access the file on disk, or whether you just want that first process to load the chunks before sending them off to the processes that are being read. That's completely up to you. Me as an ex-game dev, I'd be trying to minimize seek times. And unless I had a fairly decent RAID set up on the machine, I would say have one thing responsible for reading from disk so
and
that you minimize
binary chunks to and
exactly right. I mean, if you're sending them across the network, it would obviously make more sense to say, well, you know, if we're on a SAN or you have your own redundant copies of the data, then just pick it up from your local disk rather than me sending the information. So it would depend on the structure of your app, your topology, and where the information is stored. But the good thing is that it's really completely up to you.
Wow. It depends.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
I love it.
I sound like an agile coach.
Shut up.
Just had to drop the A word in there.
Now, at this point, you're probably thinking there's actually more to this episode. Hey, why is this suddenly stopped? But that's because there's actually a second part coming. We actually moved on to talking about React, but there's so much content there, we couldn't fit it within the half hour. And by the time we finished editing up, it was just all too big, so we've split it up. So we'll leave this at part one, and you can tune in for part two next week. Until then, happy coding, guys. See you later. Visit talkingshopdownunder.com for previous shows or to subscribe to the feed. Your feedback is always very much appreciated, so get in touch and let us know what you're thinking. Reviews can be left on iTunes or the Zoom Marketplace. Email can be sent to mail@talkingshopdownunder.com and tweets to @talking_shop. That's it for now. Show's over. Go home, people. Go home.